Hi, this is Robert Shear with another edition of Shear Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, Steve Masick. He's a professor at North Central College in Illinois. He's very involved with the American Association of University Professors. And he has written a very important article for Project Censored on the whole climate of intimidation. It has a fancy title I'm actually stumbling on. Now, give me the title again. It's about epistemology.
Yeah, Trump's attack on epistemic institutions.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, that's different than ontology. It's different because we're trying to figure out how we get information and so forth.
How we get knowledge.
Yeah,
and the idea is that, you know, we as a society, every society really, but especially, you know, kind of, you know, industrialized, liberal democratic societies like ours depend very heavily on institutions as sources of scientific insight, knowledge, and information. And my contention is that Donald Trump in his second administration has declared war on our epistemic institutions.
Yeah, and that's not kidding around, because it's the heart of the whole enterprise. And he's basically saying that anybody who challenges anyone else's thinking, debate it or so forth, is an enemy of some kind of reason and decency and what have you. I want to explain why I'm doing this particular interview, and I'll be doing I have been doing a series, but we're now making it formal. I actually have a project at SharePost, and we're taking it very seriously. And it's the AFLS. I had to have a fancy
have to have a fancy acronym.
So it's the Academic Freedom on Life Support. So we're starting from the assumption, and I also teach at a university at Annenberg and California in communications, and I think it's pretty obvious that academic freedom is on life support, and it began with Columbia really caving, and now it seems to me on the campuses. But this is something we're going to explore, and we're asking people to write about it. Hopefully you'll write about it for us. Or
I'm happy to. I spend a lot of my time studying what's happening with academic freedom, especially in the state of Illinois, but also around the country.
Yeah. So let's just begin with that, because I know your time is limited today, but hopefully I'll be able to come back to you in the future. Why don't you take it over and tell me what is going on? Is it on life support? Why do we need academic freedom? Maybe we need to speak
We could start with that. Yeah,
yeah.
We could start with what academic freedom is and why it's absolutely necessary. And then we could move on to the various ways it's under attack in this country, and especially by the Trump administration, but also by the Trump administration's allies in the various states. So, I mean, academic freedom has a pretty precise definition, and sometimes it's confused with freedom of expression as a whole, right? But it is somewhat different than simply the right to free expression. Everybody in this country, from, you know, neo-Nazis to communists, has the right to speak their mind, to publish what they want, to engage in protest activities, right? That's protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. Academic freedom is somewhat different. It is the freedom of scholars and academics to investigate their areas of research without tampering or partisan interference, to teach their subjects according to their best knowledge, again, without tampering or interference either from the administrations of the educational institutions they work for or from external parties like politicians or external pressure groups. And the reason it's so essential is we will not get reliable insight into the world, either the natural world or the social world or the political world, unless academics have that freedom, right? The freedom to research, the freedom to teach their subjects according to their best knowledge, and the freedom to publish the results of their research. Unless we have that, we will have a situation like we had, back in the 19th century, where people who were studying biology were not able to, publish in the late 19th century, where people studying human biology were not able to publish the result, were not able to publish the results of their research, were not able to teach the truth of evolution, right? Because there were all these sort of state laws saying there's only one account for the origin of the human species, and that's the biblical account, right? And if you want to go even further back, we wouldn't know about how our solar system works or how the cosmos works because everyone would have to teach the cosmology that's contained in the Old Testament. Galileo's work would never see the light of day, right? Because powers that be did not want him publicizing the fact that the Earth orbits around the sun instead of vice versa, right? Which was a contradiction to established dogma. So it's important to have robust protections for academic freedom so that scholars, researchers, and academics can discover the truth, whether it's the truth about the solar system, about the origins of the human species, or about the extent of hunger, for example, in America, or the real poverty level in the United States, whatever it is, right? We're not going to be able to discover the truth unless academics have freedom to pursue their research without partisan interference. And we are seeing, under the current Trump administration, a really unprecedented assault on the independence of universities from partisan oversight and tampering, but also the freedom of individual scholars to pursue their research without interference. I say it's unprecedented. People may know that there have been other periods in American history where the independence of the academy and academic freedom came under attack, the McCarthy era being, a really, obvious one. But the leading scholar of McCarthyism, the leading historian of McCarthyism, Ellen Schrecker, who is an AAUP member and writes frequently for AAUP publications, has said, what's happening now is worse than what happened under McCarthyism. Because under McCarthyism, individual scholars who were suspected of having communist sympathies or connections with the Communist Party were blacklisted, were fired without due process, et cetera, et cetera. But what's happening now is whole colleges and universities are coming under investigation by the Trump administration. You mentioned Columbia. What happened in the case of Columbia, I think, is just absolutely appalling. The Trump administration froze research funding for Columbia, conducted a so-called, the Department of Justice began conducting an investigation into alleged anti-Semitism or tolerance for anti-Semitism at Columbia. Columbia then agreed to settle with the Trump administration by paying the U.S. Treasury over $200 million and agreeing to give the government oversight over its teaching of certain subjects, particularly, right, Middle East studies and any courses having to do with Israel. That's an unprecedented level of tampering and interference by the federal government in the internal curricular decisions of a very prestigious American university. And they're doing it. They've done it at Northwestern. They've launched investigations and frozen funding at UCLA. ProPublica published a report quite recently it was based on some memos that they obtained, internal Justice Department memos that they obtained, that that show that like the lawyers at the Justice Department were under pressure to gin up a case against UCLA for tolerating anti-Semitism during the, you know, the anti-Gaza encampments and protests that took place a couple of years ago at UCLA, to gin up a case as a way of creating pressure on the administration to, you know, come to some sort of settlement with the Bush with the Trump administration. Now, a judge intervened and ruled in UCLA's favor, and so enjoined the freeze on, I think it was like $500 million in research funding that was earmarked for UCLA that was frozen. But it's no means certain that injunction will be permanent. So we're in a really terrifying situation. A terrifying situation. We're seeing it in the attacks on individual scholars and on students, but we're also seeing it, and what is probably more concerning, in attacks on whole universities.
Okay, so let me just summarize what we've said so far, and I agree with your historical points, and could throw in Socrates as well.
Yeah, we could throw in Socrates too.
Well, but Socrates was accepted, at least the image of we have Socrates as the greatest teacher,
right?
Maybe in human history, and even the emperors and so forth benefited from wisdom. Nonetheless, he died for his teaching, for daring to teach. And I do want to stress what you said about the McCarthy period. I went through the McCarthy period.
I'm
older than you are. And the fact of the matter is, McCarthy was an outlier, and he was attacking the president of the United States. There's a world of difference, as the Supreme Court has told us, that when it's the executive branch,
right,
the president doing it, it's different than a Senate committee or what have you, you know, which against Columbia actually started before. I do want to raise a question, though, about whether it's all Trump.
I don't think it's exclusively Trump. I think what's happening in the states is, like the state of Florida or Texas, is even more alarming.
Okay, but in the case of Florida and Texas, then you can still blame it on Trump allies, on MAGA.
Yes,
but I want to make a point here, and the AAUP, American Association of University Professors, which is a very important organization to try, they've issued some reports. But the fact is, for instance, at the University of Pennsylvania, somebody I've actually run on our site, Mr. Fish, one of the graphic artists who also does, he does the illustrations for Chris Hedges column and so forth. And he had been there for over a decade, a very popular teacher, and he was forced out based on the complaints that he somehow was anti-Semitic because he dared have some cartoons. And that was done in a Democratic blue state with blue governor, and evidently it started with the governor's office and the Annenberg school there. You basically people who seem to be quite enlightened and all that, they went along with it. And we talk about Texas, which, you know, the New York Times had a pretty good rundown on what Texas, the government there, has done to destroy one of the great educations.
It's a tragedy. Yeah.
And we should talk about that a little bit, but they're, you know, they're known for their research and not just in the medical sciences and physical, but and all through across the field. So one can point to the MAGA people in Texas and Florida doing this. On the other hand, in California, Gavin Newsom signed a bill accepting basically the definition of anti-Semitism as any serious criticism of Israel. And it does the same thing. It invites spying on professors, documenting people going after them. So I want to shift the discussion, because our time is limited here. It would be convenient to think it's all the fault of Trump and the MAGA people and so forth. And in your article, you talk about how the vice president and others have had a long time commitment to destroying the university.
Right.
An old friend and colleague of mine, David Horowitz, who I had something to
do. That's right. You worked together at the Ramparts, right?
I brought him to Ramparts.
You did?
He was working for another major intellectual, Bertrand Russell, who was being attacked, including by the New York Times.
Yeah.
And he was being attacked by the New York Times. Well, that was when he was teaching at City College, but Bertrand Russell, for daring to come out against the Vietnam War,
right,
with Sartre. The New York Times had a editorial saying he was senile or something. I actually went and interviewed him. He was anything but. He was older, but, and again, a lot of us get older, but he certainly had all his marbles there. But the reason I'm bringing this up is it would be nice to think there will be a robust opposition to this, and that it won't last past this administration, if we all last past this administration. But I normally have a very favorable view of Gavin Newsom. I think he's done a lot of very good things when he was mayor and governor and so forth. I was shocked by his signing that bill. And I want to get your reaction to it, because there's this one difference between now and the 50s and McCarthyism, because generally the Jewish community, having had the experience of totalitarian governments in Germany and rest, and throughout the world, was on the side in every poll and every voting thing,
right,
and still is, certainly for younger Jewish people, very much against this kind of control of intellectual thought, because as a minority in a minority religion, after all, much censorship came from dominant religion,
right.
So what you have now is this use of the anti-Semitism charge. And it's really quite shocking. And then to find a Democratic governor who signed off, and he will argue that he made the bill better or something, you know. But why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think you're on to something here. It is not exclusively a MAGA phenomena. I think it's worth remembering, like, the investigations of UCLA and Columbia, I think, began under Biden.
Yes.
And under the Biden Justice Department. Now, it's been weaponized by the Trump Justice Department, which is being run by somebody who I don't think actually understands First Amendment law, Pam Bondi. I think you've got to wonder where she got her law degree. The leadership of the Democratic Party in this country have long been supporters of Israel. They've authorized the sending of billions of dollars in arms to the Israeli government, even after Netanyahu, took over, and he's not just incredibly corrupt, but is somebody who really wants to, appropriate the West Bank and Gaza. He wants to take it over, and he wants to drive the Palestinians out. And the Democratic Party has long supported him. So
that's a different issue. Look, I'm going to interrupt because you're it's 30 minutes. It's one thing you can support Israel.
Sure.
No, in the most full-throated way, in the most uncritical way, that's a different issue. In fact, that's your right. That's your right to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
What I am concerned about here, and that should not be forgotten, is they are trying to silence people.
Right.
And it's not obviously just now with the Republicans, you could say they're trying to silence them even if they believe in vaccines and
Right.
Believe maybe women weren't always equal to men in every aspect of American history. So the anti-woke thing goes very far. And, the fact of the matter is the main weaponizing was not available to intolerant people in the 1950s, because the Jewish community on the highest level, whatever they thought about Israel, and it was a different Israel, of course, much
right, easier, right.
to defend. But that wasn't the issue. The issue is whether that gets weaponized on the basis of somebody in a classroom taking notes or taking a camera picture or something, which has happened, and people are being fired. And so
they absolutely are, and they're being fired for speech about Palestine and the Israel's war in Gaza or Israel's abuse of Palestinians in Gaza. But they're also being fired for simply sharing their reactions to the assassination of Charlie Kirk, right, who was the founder of a very McCarthyite organization, Turning Point USA. It was a tragedy that he was killed as he was about to speak on a college campus. That's bad for everybody's freedom of expression, right? Absolutely. But a number of people, a number of academics and graduate students have been either disciplined, suspended, or outright fired for simply talking about what Charlie Kirk actually stood for when he was alive, was racist, right-wing, reactionary policies. And they, I mean, it's stunning. There was a law professor in Arkansas who was fired. There was a cancer researcher at Emory University who was fired. A number of academics at three professors at Florida Atlantic University were suspended. And if you look at what they said about the Charlie Kirk assassination, it absolutely was First Amendment protected speech. So it is, when I referred to, the Kirk assassination and the way the Trump administration has tried to use that to silence their critics as like the MAGA movement's Horst Wessel moment. Horst Wessel was this like completely unsavory character who was murdered, who was then elevated, was a Nazi party member in Germany in the 30s, who was then turned into this heroized, right, to rally the supporters of Nazism. Like that is what's currently happening with the memory of Charlie Kirk. On the basis of this, I know you know this, Trump, issued an executive order declaring Antifa, that is to say, people who are opposed to fascism, as terrorists. and that, even though there was, if you look at the executive order, there's actually no real definition of what Antifa is. It's this vague amorphous smear that you can use against any academic, against any activist who is critical. So, I agree, going back to your point, that the weaponization of the charge of anti-Semitism is not confined just to MAGA. It's been used. It's been used by Democratic politicians as well, and by corporate leaders who really don't have any partisan politics. Their politics is to make money. Right, they care only about profit. They're willing to support Gavin Newsom or support Donald Trump if they think they're going to make a buck from it. And so, they're sort of in that sense non-ideological.
Okay. Let me say we're limited for time. Otherwise, we could take much more time and we can talk again.
Right.
I'm trying to get an assessment of where we are, and you're at a critical position to understand this because you were involved with the American Association of University, probably the main organization that's pushing back. And what I want to examine now in the remaining 7 minutes we have,
Give
me another 10, I'll do that too.
I can give you 10. I can give you 10.
All right. So let me just be clear about this. What I want to get at, and the reason we call it academic freedom on life support, I think there's really some evidence, and we're going to examine this as carefully as we can, in as scholarly a fashion as we can, but from eyeballing it and just roughly looking around and reading what's going on, I think the war for intolerance, the war on academic freedom, has in a significant measure already been won. To begin with, the idea that one of your major institutions, Columbia University, could cave in the way they did and still be considered a respectable university what they did is shameful. But even Harvard, for example, which put up some resistance, is trying to find ways of accommodating this. And but more to the point, on the university campuses, one reason we started this project is to draw more attention, because it's not paying attention. And to begin with, you even have your tenured faculty are objectively threatened by this.
Right.
You know, these are the people who thought they were invulnerable to such attacks. But, you know, much of the teaching on campuses these days, even very prestigious universities, sometimes as high as 80% or so, is done by people who are not tenured.
Right, and, right.
Adjunct or, some other different status, where they actually have, even when they have a 3-year contracts or 5-year contracts, can really be, you know, fired very quickly and have no rights. What I am detecting, and we're trying to get people onto campuses, students and others who might be listening to this, faculty as well, to write about what is the reality there. And I get the feeling, just from the last semester, that basically people are engaging in self-censorship. You've been involved, very involved with Project Censorship, which assumes the censorship comes from government, and that's what the traditional. No, self-censorship is really the way, main way to, overtly totalitarian societies work.
You know, absolutely.
The government at some point doesn't have to do much. I know I spent time in the old Soviet Union reporting and stuff, and it was very clear. Very intelligent people who are capable of critical thinking just shut up and just don't go in certain directions, even though they're absolutely, there were brilliant scientists, both physical scientists, social scientists in Russia to this day, but, you know, they went along. If we go to Germany or any other or religious-oriented totalitarian societies, I've traveled in a few of those as well, you know, self-censorship is the normal mechanism. And then in a society
absolutely.
Where we have a surveillance technology now, and any email you write, any, you know, almost any conversation, anything you do, and one point I make often, when they went after Martin Luther King, our Democratic administration, LBJ,
right,
even Bobby Kennedy was the Attorney General, they went after Martin Luther King, they actually had to physically tap into his phone or listen in the hotel room
right
next door. Now you can get it, and everybody's just doing something on Yelp or
right
network and so forth. So people know that. They know, and so they're shutting up. And they're not, and the punishment was very severe on these campuses on their demonstrations about Gaza, but on other subjects.
Absolutely. No, I agree that rising self-censorship among students and among faculty is a serious problem. I think it began before even 2016, right before Trump first became president. It had already begun. And I think it was in part, it's in part an effect of the economic war on higher education. So we have this ideological war that the primarily conservatives, you know, like J.D. Vance and Charlie Kirk were waging against colleges and universities. But at the same time, politicians of both parties were busy defunding higher education at the state level, imposing austerity on higher education, and then imposing neoliberal administrators on colleges and universities who, among other things, were responsible for this massive shift in who teaches courses, right? I know, because I've been a department chair and I've hired adjunct faculty, right, who teach one or two courses per semester. They don't have any job security, so they're precarious. They're desperate to be hired back again the following year. And so they want to avoid at all costs offending anyone, right? Offending their students, offending their colleagues, their faculty colleagues, or certainly they don't want to get on the bad side of the administration. Well, if those are the people who are in the classrooms teaching classes, it is not going to broaden the horizons of your students, right? Because part of the way that students, are forced to contemplate, to reflect on their own beliefs, and to change their mind on certain subjects, is to be challenged and confronted. But I think the whole, adjunctification of higher education, the fact that you have this growing segment of part-time faculty who have no rights, or very few rights, have very little job security, means that they're not going to push their students in the way that they should.
But even
they're going to bite their tongues rather than speak out. Now, I don't think this is true of every part-time faculty member. I've known some adjuncts who have been very independently minded, have not been afraid to talk about controversial subjects. But I think the majority are self-censoring.
Well, but there is evidence now. The campuses have been just about silent.
Right.
They went from a very robust, exciting, whatever side you're on, these issues, there's no question the students.
There was robust debate and discussion.
And so forth. And the crackdown worked. But I want to extend it to tenured faculty, because the fact is, and we should talk about some specifics here, they have been targeted. And suddenly it turns out tenure doesn't mean anything.
In certain states, and in certain, like, for example, the University of Texas, where they fired somebody for speaking out in favor of revolutionary socialism at a conference off campus, not to his class, not to any of his students, not to an audience on campus, but an off-campus event, and he has been stripped of tenure. It is terrifying, and I have to say, this is the AAUP position, but I agree with the position. The best protection for academic freedom is tenure. And what does tenure mean? It means that you cannot dismiss a faculty member from their position unless you prove that they're incompetent to teach their subject. So you can't dismiss them for what we call extracurricular speech, for speaking out as a citizen about political issues of various kinds, for airing their opinions. You can only fire them for not carrying out their duties as a professor, doing adequate research, not teaching in a competent way. And the people who judge, who should sit in judgment over a faculty member who is going to be stripped of tenure, are not administrators, not college presidents who are appointed by governors, by politicians, but the faculty themselves. It should be a peer group, the community of scholars who then determine that somebody is not doing their job.
It all sounds wonderful. When I was a kid in the Bronx.
It does sound wonderful, but it doesn't always work in practice. We don't really have that.
When I was a kid in the Bronx, I'd hear an argument like that, and somebody said, well, I've got this protection, blah, blah. And this was during the McCarthy period, actually. About a lot of things, and somebody in those days, of course, you nickel to get on the subway, and they say, yeah, that and the nickel will get you on the subway. And when we look at the reality, and that's, after all, epistemology is supposed to be about, right? Looking at how it actually works out, and what is the theory about how it works out. The fact is, the campuses are silent. In a place like Columbia, where there's such an extreme case, they're going about their work, they're getting their grants, and the tenured faculty, because first of all, one of the things about tenure is you only get the full level and the big, really big bucks if you play the game and jump through the hoops.
Move
up the ranks.
And pass all these reviews.
As it's turning out now, though, even if you have that protection, you can't be fired, maybe in the extreme, you won't get the grants. And then the university will say, wait a minute, your big lab has to be closed down.
Right. No, that's
there's support. And the fact is, this is all I want to end with, because in these discussions, and I've done it a bit too, but you also suddenly can smile about it or see the irony and make a joke. The fact is, we're talking about the destruction of freedom in the United States.
Yes.
And the particular litmus test we're using is what happens on the campuses. That's this academic freedom you're talking about. And as we know from Socrates and Galileo and Bertrand Russell,
If
you can crack down on your most famous intellectuals, you know, you're going to get everybody. You're going to get the person in the street. They're not going to open their mouth. And then, in fact, what you're trying to do is send a message to students and future leaders and certainly future voters, hey, you better keep your mouth shut, keep your nose clean, and not go in that direction. And so we have on these campuses gone, UCLA is a very good example, where, you know, and by the way, the violence on UCLA came from people who were not protesting about civil rights in Gaza. They were people who were quite belligerent about anybody protesting and breaking up their camps. But leaving the facts aside, you know, what I'm objecting to when people sort of say, oh, yeah, and it's, you know, okay, and you can even smile. The fact is, I think they've won. Now, whether that can be reversed, but right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'd love to be wrong on this, but right now, my sense is that on the campuses, and I'm basically eyeballing it through the media and what I can read and hear, they're very quiet. So why are they so quiet if there's a lot? Forget about just Israel. Right. I mean, there's, you know, Venezuela. There's what's going on in relations to other countries, Ukraine or whatever. You know, there's a lot to discuss. And certainly the growing income inequality in the United States. You have a paper like the Washington Post, which now endorsed the attack on Venezuela.
I saw that.
And but think about it. The big thing that has changed in America is this incredible income growth. And we have the trillionaire to be class, the top 13 or whatever they are. I just saw a story about it. They increased their wealth by 30% in just the last 5 years or something. It's stunning. Well, you can't discuss any of that because then you're doing
wealth. I mean, I think that I'll push back a little bit in that I think that it is happening on certain campuses intermittently, that there are, you know, conversations, discussions, you know, presentations, panels, and so on. But what it isn't adding up to is a kind of campus-based, you know, movement to push back against the assault on higher. I mean, I do think that the AAUP and other, you know, faculty unions, it's not just the AAUP, are, you know, holding protests about this, are holding public events about this. I'm going to be going to an event in Chicago on Friday, which, you know, is a bunch of academics who have been fired or suspended, usually for talking about Palestine, which is, you know, the third rail in American academia. So there are events, there are, you know, there are presentations, there are, you know, there are conferences about this, but I agree with you that it seems like I'm not seeing a lot of student activism around this. And I think the majority of faculty are terrified, right? They're afraid that they're going to end up in the crosshairs.
Okay, but so what is the value of tenure? Where is it? You just put out a theoretical construct there that, oh, tenure and you can't get fired this way and they have to do this. It turns out, and this is where we get back to Project Censored.
Right.
Back to, it's not, the government doesn't have to do much. The government, it turns out actually, in what are ostensibly democratic, free societies, it's very often easier. At least in the old Soviet Union, I know I went there as a reporter, I found very few people that thought Pravda told you the truth.
Told you the truth, right.
Which was what literally the title meant. I found very few people, whatever they were, whether they were in the Communist Party or not, that thought Izvesta really, they told you the government position. People knew that. You know, I interviewed lots of people. I interviewed people even who were in the Politburo, you know, and so forth. And they couldn't with a straight face tell you that, you know, oh yeah, just read the paper, you know, and because they knew the game was totally rigged, so they reserved their conversation for the kitchen table or for some. So okay, we here have the illusion, this is why I'm interested in talking to people about it, that suddenly has been torn asunder. We had the illusion that we had certain guarantees of the limits of government power, of our free speech, including, of course, academic freedom, which I would repeat is the most central, because if you can't have freedom in your high schools and colleges and so forth, you're not going to have it anywhere.
Right.
And, you know, and the two of us, we don't want to get bummed out. We don't want to start crying, woe is woe. But I am shocked, and this is what we're investigating, and again, I want to keep an open mind on it. Maybe it's different where you teach. Maybe it's different in Illinois. I don't know. You got a governor who seems pretty gutsy at challenging the administration.
He has pushed back against the administration on certain things, especially on sending National Guard troops to Chicago to round up people.
But are there, even on that issue, are there campus debates about it and discussion and objection to it?
There are, but I agree that there are not as many as there should be. And I also agree that most tenured faculty are much too timid. And
much,
it's
what?
Much too timid.
Yes.
They are, of all the people in the university, of all the people in colleges, of anybody in the college, they're the ones who are most empowered to speak their mind and to speak the truth, right? And most of them won't because of fear of reprisal. I do think that the rise of groups like Turning Point USA and others that are like Canary Mission, right, which monitors academic speech about Israel-Palestine, that those groups have really succeeded in chilling a lot of faculty speech. Faculty are intimidated. They're afraid of being targeted. I know I have... You've been fairly outspoken on some issues, and I've gotten angry calls, angry anonymous. I'm sure you get them every day. I've gotten angry anonymous calls. I haven't had any death threats recently, but you get threatening phone calls and threatening messages. And now, because of the administration's actions, you could be afraid. You could be legitimately afraid that you might lose your job if you were in a state that doesn't provide you with kind of robust protections for tenure, like Florida or Tennessee or Georgia or Texas. Basically, the states that.
Well, now you have to put California in there. New York wasn't very good because. Look what happened to Columbia. So despite the pretenses of a liberal democratic.
Oh, no, it's true. It's true. It's true. I think, no place can you feel really secure. But my argument is, use it or lose it. If you have tenure, then you have an obligation to speak out about these issues, and especially an obligation to speak up in favor of academic freedom. Right. Should be the first obligation of every tenured faculty member.
You've been very kind to give me this time. I'm going to ask with one last question. You take
sure.
as much time as you feel you have. But one of the great mysteries of life for me as a journalist, as I've been traveled to many societies, I was in North Vietnam. I was actually in Korea. I was in Algeria during a rough time. I was in Egypt at the time of the Six-Day War, as well as
right.
in Israel. I was in the old Soviet Union. And so I've been in a lot. I was in Cuba. Been a lot of places. And for most places I visited that had totalitarian governments or certainly strongly authoritarian governments,
right.
whether they were based on Marx or on Jesus or on Muhammad or whatever, it was very clear to me why most people could not overtly, openly speak out. And I never condemned them for it. I thought, my God, they'll be tortured. They'll be arrested.
They'll be imprisoned.
Their lives will be destroyed. Their families will be destroyed and so forth. We are still, we're getting there, maybe. We're still not there. And there are still restraints. And you call talk to one of them, which is central to our project here, the Academic Freedom on Life Support. It, you know, that presumably with some of the guarantees of academic freedom, and hopefully they extend beyond tenure, but, you know, in terms of rules of a university, you know, and after all, one reason they keep unions out is they say, no, you're not at will. And
right, you're not at will, you're a manager, not a worker, right?
That's very active, and so forth. One would have thought this would be a no-brainer now, that you know, it's not, okay, I could go to the old Soviet Union and say, why aren't you speaking out? I was a fellow at the Center for Canada-U.S. Relations. I wrote for Moscow News once on loan from the L.A. Times. I never dared suggest to any of these people, I demand you speak out, or right, why aren't you speaking out? I mean, here I was coming from, you know, the United States. I had guarantees and rights. So I'm asking this question now, though. You know, it seems to be working in many ways more effectively, because people still retain the illusion that we are a democratic society, a society of rule of law, that you have rights, that you can appeal. And the fact is, we're in an atmosphere now where these things are just torn apart.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, when we installed Ngo Dinh Diem in Vietnam, or we you know, did things internationally, they hid behind language. They fabricated. Now right. You go in and pluck the leader of Venezuela. Oh, God, you're in Brooklyn.
It is absolutely stunning. Right. It is absolutely stunning.
So there are no longer illusions. When there are no longer illusions, it works to intimidate people.
Yeah.
That's my big question of that I'm pursuing here, because it seems to me that the whole system of protection that defined our society, thanks to our founders, for all of their imperfections, they did put in separation of church and state. They did put in, limited power of the different branches of government. They put in individual rights, all of which we have proclaimed to the world. As
a point of pride for our country, right?
Well, but also sanity, and that everybody should have this and have these rules, hasn't in any way intruded on this march to totalitarianism so far. It's really, isn't that the most frightening observation one can make? But isn't it also accurate?
I would agree that it is accurate. I think, you know, we have seen some victories in court, legal challenges to some of the administration's actions and to some of the attacks on academic freedom. But as I say in the article that I wrote for that you posted on SharePost, you can't count on the courts any longer to protect these fundamental freedoms. And you certainly can't count on the courts to protect academic freedom. It's going to take a movement that unites faculty, K-12 teachers, students, social justice activists, labor activists. It is going to take a broad-based movement to push back against what is happening, to bring academic freedom and other freedoms off of life support, to go back to the title of your project, right? To get academic freedom and other civil liberties off of life support is going to take a broad movement. We cannot count on the courts or other institutions that we used to count on.
Well, let's wrap it up with that. But, it requires and demands further examination. That's why we're doing this academic freedom life support. And by the way, I would love to discover that our title is wrong. And I would too. Maybe we should put it as a question. Yeah. Academic freedom on life support, ? I don't know. But the reality is, there's very little reason for optimism now. And it's a question we all have to ask on a very deep level, because all of us, and I can't say speak for all of us, but almost all people I know, whether they're, David Horowitz when he was on the left and David Horowitz when he was on the right, and for people who don't know David Horowitz, he's probably as close as you have to a the inspiration for this attack on the campus.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Someone who, in a book that he once wrote, student praised me highly, and we were colleagues, and I brought him to Ramparts and so forth. And then he, of course, is, as much as anyone, the author of this mad attack on the universities and so forth. So this one of the really frightening things. He was an early opportunist.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's the only way you really, I think, can explain it. If you look at actually the books he wrote, and then how did you suddenly, and I remember asking him on a couple occasions, how did you just jump? And I mean, he indicated, I want to quote somebody who's no longer with us and can't defend himself. But I mean, just look at his writings, and how do you just suddenly dismiss books you've written, and then you go in a whole different direction. And without, you know, he wrote something about that, but not a whole lot. But you have this situation now where it seems to me, and I think this is we must investigate it and think about it, because it's like the old holes in the dike thing. If academic freedom goes, you don't have much chance.
No, it's true.
It is really the lesson, I think, of every totalitarian experience, certainly Nazi Germany. I mean, the main target was the educational system.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
To the high school level. And, you know, we have a guy, Jim Mamer. He's written a lot for SharePost. He was a high school social studies teacher of the year. He's the director of our academic freedom. I hope I'm not putting him on the spot here. project, but he was also was at teaching at the University of California at Irvine and all that sort of thing. So he's gone the full circuit. And, you know, it's interesting because when I first was talking about it, he was trying to say, well, we have restraints and so forth. But then, you know, you look at what's happening, and one thing he's been quite expert on is textbooks. He's probably, after Frankie Francis Fitzgerald's book on textbooks, he's probably done the major work on really how textbooks are selected and how they get to be distorted and everything.
Right.
And have both Texas and California now accepting a degree of censorship on the most important subject of, you know.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know.
And Indiana as well.
Yeah.
Indiana banned the use of Howard Zinn's People's History of America from its K-12 classrooms.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So when you have that happening, you know, you can really forget about education as a zone of sanity. And we know, you know, you can look at, I mean, I'm not particularly picking on any one society, but you look at societies we have defined as certainly deeply authoritarian, if not totalitarian, say China,
right,
say Russia, but China is a very good example. You know, you can get great science up to a point while suppressing political thought.
You can, but at a certain point, I could come back, and I know we're running out of time. I could come back and talk about that
but I just want to finish the sentence here, that the Chinese have learned, as the Russians learned, that you can't do it for long.
Right.
And the fact is, the reason they're able to attract scientists is an irony, one of the great ironies of this whole modern history, is that people who left a place like China, communist China,
right,
came to a place like the United States because they thought they would get a higher measure of freedom,
right,
and their work would not be interfered, are now in droves returning
to the people.
Because they're afraid that this hysteria in the United States, this attack on them, will affect even one of the leading individuals on artificial intelligence and everything in Harvard. Goes back. If you read the South China Morning Post, which is owned by Alibaba, but still, they have almost daily reports of famous award-winning scientists
returning
to China. They're not doing it because they need a better job or need more money. They're doing it because they're afraid for their freedom, even though they're not writing and doing stuff on politics.
Right. No, absolutely.
I think that is sort of a defining story. We're making the Chinese and even Putin in Russia, because he's, you know, he's not a communist now, he's actually anti-communist. And we're making even countries that have theocratic administrations were making them look more acceptable or
look
better.
Attractive, yes.
Yeah, because of yeah. these policies. And as I say, this scary thing is it's not just Trump.
It's no, not it's not. Trump. You're right. It's not. It's not.
You know, let's wrap it up on that note, and I'll be checking with you again.